Hello, Akita. This is Tangata Utemoana from RNZ Pacific. I'm Don Wiseman. And today, PNG's Prime Minister's on a state visit to New Zealand. An attack on refugees by a Port Moresby mob raises security questions. Two government MPs and the Solomons lose their seats over bribery. Has the Fiji government wrecked the trade union movement there? And the Australian government's change of focus on Pacific aid is called a strategic misstep. Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister James Marape's on a four-day state visit to New Zealand. His first visit to New Zealand by a sitting PNG Prime Minister since 2013. Johnny Blades reports that Mr. Marape is looking to elevate the relationship between the two countries.
James Marape says this visit is a chance for him to thank New Zealand for being a genuine friend. In particular, he says he wants to thank New Zealand for helping evacuate Papua New Guinean students from China's coronavirus-stricken city of Wuhan earlier this month. Those 17 students were among dozens who were released yesterday from quarantine in Whangaparoa, and they were given the all clear. PNG is very grateful for that help and for a number of areas of cooperation.
What other things is he looking to get out of the visit?
Well, he's talking about getting New Zealand help with part of the series of reforms that his government is embarking on back in PNG. For instance, the public sector. Now, he says New Zealand's public sector is the most effective and efficient he knows of, and he wants the head of the Parliamentary Committee on Public Service Reform, Gary Juffa, who's coming along with him to New Zealand to set up a link whereby PNG can study New Zealand's public service and to model it for reform of PNG's very much ailing public service. There are other areas as well, for instance, just talking about continuation of certain projects in the New Zealand aid program. Also, he wants to build business and trade links between New Zealand and PNG, remembering two-way trade is about $300 million New Zealand dollars each year, but it's heavily in favour of New Zealand, and I think PNG would like to see that balanced up a bit.
The two countries have a good relationship, but it sometimes feels dwarfed on both ends by the relationship with Australia, doesn't it?
You know, Australia is a lot bigger and, of course, is very much the main partner for Papua New Guinea. But there's so many areas that New Zealand and PNG could pursue links in, and that's what Marape is looking for. But there is the weight that Australia can throw around. For instance, when New Zealand had offered to take a bunch of the refugees who were sent up to PNG's Manus Island for, you know, a number of years by Australia, both of the governments wanted this offer to be taken up, both New Zealand and PNG, but Australia wouldn't allow it, essentially, being afraid that might, you know, create an incentive for more asylum seekers to try and get into Australia through the back door. You know, that's a source of frustration, but I think New Zealand and PNG can, make it on their own in a number of ways.
Marape is still very early in his tenure as Prime Minister, and he's under a lot of pressure. Do you think he's likely to last the full term?
It's difficult to tell. He's under huge pressure because of all these problems which are confronting his government as it tries to introduce reform. You know, they've got law and order crises, endemic corruption. He's trying to turn around an ailing economy. The government is just struggling to get basic public services to the mainly rural population. And this, if they can get that thing right, that's a start. And I think that's where he sees things like this trip to New Zealand to further build on constructive partnerships. I think that's where he's looking to make some inroads.
That's Johnny Blades speaking there with Karoy Hawkins. A Manus Island refugee has a broken leg and several others are injured after being attacked by an angry mob this week in Port Moresby. A refugee advocate says the attack highlights the lack of security being provided for the refugees in PNG. Ben Robinson-Drawbridge has more.
Sudanese refugee Yasser Omar says the attack in the suburb of Baroko started at 11 o'clock on Tuesday night when refugees were accosted outside their accommodation by intoxicated locals.
They are drunk, so they come and attack the people. One of my friends, they start to fight with him. And then we go back to inside. They try to broke the gate and come inside. And then they start again, they try to destroy the stool inside. And some of my friends, they get angry. They hit him by his tool. One of the guy in the head, and another in the hand, and another guy, the leg broken 3 times.
Two guards employed by the building owner were also hurt in the melee and fled. Refugees called police but were told the closest squad car was out of petrol. About 20 angry locals shouting, "Get out of our country," continued to try to force their way inside the complex until about 1:30 on Wednesday morning when police finally arrived. They fired warning shots which dispersed the crowd. Mr. Omar says refugees and locals have a history of tension in Boroko.
Every time when we went to outside, they say, "We don't want to hear, go back," and, you know, some people just wearing us, and they say, you know, "We kill you." Just every time like this.
18 refugees live in the Boroko complex. About 180 others reside in hotels and rental accommodation across Port Moresby, where they were transferred last year. They're all that remain in PNG of the 1,500 or so men who were forcibly detained on Manus Island by Australia in 2013. The refugee advocate Ian Rintoul says the Boroko attack was probably motivated by xenophobia.
They're just, you know, kind of lashing out. You know, it's just like what we've seen before. You know, people, you know, just, you know, got any kind of grievance, but the refugees seem like an easy outlet. But to actually attack the hotel, like to try and get through the gate and through the door, and of course the security, all they've got is security for the hotel. They just ran away, they left, and it was just up to the refugees to try and, you know, hold the gate. And that's when one of the guys got his, you know, leg broken. They were just pelting the place with rocks.
With the contract of the controversial security company Paladin terminated last year, Mr. Rintoul says it's fallen to the refugee service provider, JDA, to protect the refugees.
And they did put the announcement around the end of last year saying that all security would be withdrawn from the hotels when they were dispersing people. It would be very interesting to know whether there's any requirement for security written into the contract that JDA has with Australia, but certainly none is being provided, and it's they need that, you know, immediately. I mean, no one's going to sleep any longer at Boroko after tonight. They'll be standing guard on that gate.
The Australian government did not reply to questions about who's handling refugee security. Yasser Omar says for now it's up to the refugees themselves.
From last night to until right now, nobody sleeps. All the people tension, and, you know, they are scared about what's happening. And because really no safety here, they can attack us again.
Yasser Omar ending that report from Ben Robinson Drawbridge. Two government MPs in Solomon Islands have lost their seats after being found guilty of bribing voters. The Education Minister, Moffat Fugui, and backbencher James Zavokia, both had election petitions brought against them upheld by the High Court on Friday last week. Karoy Hawkins reports.
Moffat Fugui was found guilty of giving about $60 to a voter on the eve of last April's national election. The petition was filed by Alfred Efona, who lost to Mr. Fugui by over 1,000 votes in the central Honiara constituency. Mr. Efona's lawyer, David Lidimani, says the ruling has restored the public's faith in the judiciary, which he says had eroded after earlier election petitions were dismissed by the courts.
When ours came out, the ruling came out, it was really a big turnaround in terms of public perception of the judiciary and, of course, our legal system. Now, for our clan, of course, it's a big victory, not for himself, but of course for people in the country. That's the way he puts it.
The other ousted MP, Jamie Wokia, was found guilty of 3 counts of bribery. His victory over the incumbent MP for Northwest Goro Canal, former Prime Minister Derek Sikor, was one of the biggest upsets of last year's election. The head of the Electoral Commission, Moses Saitala, says as well as losing their seats, the two former government MPs are banned from voting or standing in any election in Solomon Islands for the next 5 years. Mr. Saitala says he understands tensions between the supporters of the unseated former MPs and their petitioners will be high, but he is appealing to the community to keep the peace.
We sincerely beg people to respect the law. That is the law enacted by Parliament. We also hope that when we conduct the by-elections in the next few months, it will be peaceful and that everybody participates.
Election petitions in Solomon Islands are conducted by the High Court as civil matters, but the chair of Transparency Solomon Islands, Ruth Lilongula, questions whether the two politicians who have lost their seats will also face criminal charges for bribery. Ms. Lilongula says ideally all election petition cases, whether successful or not, should be taken further if criminal allegations are involved.
We're just going through ticking the boxes of which one suits us, but we have not. We really need to relook at our electoral act, and we really need to work at getting some things that would address the criminality of the acts that they've been found guilty of or not found guilty of, and who is the responsible authority to take up these cases.
Moses Saitala says the country's new independent commission against corruption, which is still being established, would be the obvious authority to take up these matters. In its absence, he says it is up to the police to take up the cases. Of the 18 electoral petitions still before the High Court, 6 of them have been to trial and are awaiting judgment. Mr. Saitala says under the new Electoral Act, all election petitions have to be processed by May. This is Koroi Hawkins.
The Fijian government's been accused of wrecking the trade union movement in the country. The opposition claims that while the government professes to respect the rights of Fijian workers, it's failed to honour its agreements with unions. Christine Ravoy has more.
Addressing Parliament this week, the National Federation Party leader said the Employment Relations Act and political parties' decree limited the rights of trade union leaders in Fiji. Biman Prasad says the government is breaking the workers' and the trade union harmony in the country.
They've been lying about the trade union movement, they've been lying about the workers' rights, they've been lying to ILO, they've been lying all over the place. Let's be honest, the trade union movement in this country has been applying for permits for peaceful marches. They have not even bothered to give a reason why the permit for marches have not been granted.
During a heated debate, Mr. Prasad warned that the weakening of the rights of workers and trade unions will lead to problems with low wages, problems with industrial relations harmony, and issues with respect to the confidence in the economy.
They run a workshop and say that we are going to review the essential national industries list. They don't do that. So what do the trade union leaders do in this country? And they expect the trade union leaders to go and sit with them in the Labour Advisory Board.
In 2016, the government signed a tripartite agreement with unions to address issues of labour law reform and essential national industries issues. The agreement was to provide the unions with an equal seat at the table. But opposition MP Lenora Ngerengeretambua told the House the tripartite agreement is not working.
Unions, I believe, are boycotting the ERAB, because government is not complying with the timelines in respect of review of labour laws.
However, Attorney General Ayaz Sayyed Kayum says the union's refusal to participate on the board is political. Former Employment Minister Choni Usamate also refutes Ms. Ngerengeretambua's claims.
She has basically stated that the unions have not been participating into the Employment Relations Advisory Board because they are talking about the permit, the refusal to give the permit. The Ministry of Employment has got nothing to do with permits. If you want the tripartite mechanism to function, you need to come to the party, sit and make it.
Mr. Usamate urges the opposition and the unions to contribute to the tripartite discussions.
But to see the proof of the pudding, you look at unemployment rate in this country. The last findings on unemployment put youth unemployment in this country at only 4.5%. That is the proof of the pudding.
The government this month suspended 5 trade unions for failing to submit their annual audited reports. It said the unions also faced penalties and deregistration if they continued to fail to comply with legislation. Meanwhile, the head of the National Workers' Union, Felix Anthony, is due in court next month, charged with malicious behaviour under the Public Order Act. Mr. Anthony, who has pleaded not guilty, was among unionists arrested last year after members protested the termination of over 2,000 jobs at the Fiji Water Authority. This is Christine Ravoy.
You're listening to Tangaroa Temuana, and still to come, rehabilitation programs top the list for reforms within Kiribati's correction system. Vanuatu's political leaders expect another fragmented parliament to emerge after the upcoming general election. And New Zealand Rugby is appointing a Pacifica engagement manager. He'll be tasked with giving the Pacific Island community here more of a voice. But first, an Australian aid group says the government's change of focus on Pacific aid is a strategic misstep. Australia is spending more on foreign aid to the Pacific, providing about $1.4 billion Australian dollars in the 2019-2020 year as part of its so-called Pacific step-up. But this aid spend has seen a move towards infrastructure spending with less going to health. The Director of Policy and Advocacy at the Australian Council for International Development, Bridie Rice, told me about this change in direction.
Look, Australia's Pacific step-up has been, by and large, a great thing. We've seen more ministers travelling to the Pacific. We're finally seeing Australia's role in the Pacific being taken really seriously. And with that has come an aid allocation to the Pacific region that has increased to now its highest level at $1.4 billion. But this Pacific step-up has meant a step down in other critical parts of the region in Australia. And it's also come at a cost to expenditure on health and otherwise. So things like underinvestment in disease prevention remains a really significant regional challenge for Australia. And yet Australia has actually reduced its overall total health investments from over about $800 million in 2014 to $562 million in 2018-2019. So it's just not all adding up.
Well, and it's coming at a time when there have been these very high-profile problems with clearly showing that health systems in the Pacific are not working. We've had the measles epidemic in Samoa, polio in Papua New Guinea. And in a sense, more money should be going into health rather than less.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, at the very same time that we're seeing these cuts to health, the Pacific has been experiencing somewhat of a health crisis. You mentioned the measles in Samoa, Tonga, Fiji, Kiribati as well. But there's also been a spread of drug-resistant tuberculosis and the re-emergence of polio in the environment. At the same time, Australia has been increasing its spend elsewhere on infrastructure projects, for example. And whilst these are beneficial and needed in the Pacific, they are critical investments in economic growth, I just don't think our development programs should cut core investments for development, health being one. I mean, the links between health and poverty reduction are well known, and the links between poverty reduction and regional stability are really clear. So we think it's nothing short of strategic misstep to be reducing health and core development spending on education as well at this time.
In terms of this emphasis on infrastructure, when you say it's needed, well, how clear is that it is needed?
I think there's general consensus amongst the Pacific as well as the broader international community that infrastructure is critical to development in the Pacific. But it's only one piece of the puzzle. And there are different courses. For every one infrastructure that is large and shiny and making great new headlines, there are really, really serious community infrastructure needs and social infrastructure needs as well. For every investment in a large hospital, we also need to be investing in the people to run it, the roads to get there, the health workers to play outreach on it as well. So we'd like to see Australia's investment in infrastructure being very, very pro-development and consistent with the needs that are being articulated from the Pacific.
One of the issues, I guess, is that these sorts of programs now are multi-year programs, but I imagine an organisation like yours would be advocating that the government do a dramatic rethink on what its current plans are.
That's right. Look, you may be aware that Australia is taking a look at its current international development policy, and we've been advocating for a return to the core development needs of the Pacific. So what that means for us is let's not think about development in 2 months or 6 months or 12 months or even 2 year blocks. Let's think about what we're hearing from leaders of the Pacific around the region that they want to live in 10, 20 and 30 year horizons. And what we hear when we listen to those voices is that the basics are critical. Health, education, and deep, trusted relationships with countries like New Zealand and Australia is what our neighbours are after. So we'd like to see a shift of the development program back to those long-term strategic aspirations that we know are critical for sustainable development and that we know are critical for a really stable and prosperous future.
That's the Director of Policy and Advocacy at the Australian Council for International Development, Bridie Rice. Rehabilitation programs top the list for reforms within the Kiribati correction system. Local parole board members and corrections staff have been in New Zealand discussing the reforms and ways to improve their work, too, as part of a Pacific Parole Partnership. Karoi Hawkins has more.
Compared to Kiribati, New Zealand's parole board is a behemoth, with almost 10,000 cases dealt with last year, compared to Kiribati's 21. But the chair of the Kiribati Parole Board, Betarem Remon, says some of New Zealand's systems and best practices could be applicable back home, especially as they look to reform the country's outdated parole legislation.
Time has overtaken the issues and new developments, and culture is dynamic and people change, and so there is also a need to revisit our act and to see relevant areas to be amended, to be improved, to be changed.
Mr. Raymond's New Zealand counterpart is Sir Ron Young, who also serves on the appeal courts of Solomon Islands and Vanuatu. Sir Ron says most of the things they have been discussing have been procedural, such as meeting with parolees face-to-face and including victims in the parole assessments.
So it's the wide variety of things that would ordinarily come up on parole. One of the things that we're also trying to support them on is rehabilitative programs. At present, they don't really have any. They're keen to do that, and they're keen to learn from corrections, New Zealand corrections, and the parole board as to what we have and how they might adapt that for use in Kiribati.
I met the Kiribati delegation 2 days into their busy itinerary, which will see them visiting correctional facilities in Wellington and Otago. But the Kiribati Parole Board Director, Abuera Uruata, seemed to already be brimming with ideas to improve their work back home.
We'll propose a change to our Parole Board Act. We'll put up a cabinet paper to the cabinet for other processes and other matters that need to be implemented, because I think the only two things that matter most for parole applications is the safety of the society and the fairness of the hearings.
The Pacific Parole Partnership initiative is driven by Sir Ron Young.
Well, they think it's important because they think it's important for their own country, and it's important to support things like parole boards because it's part of a democratic society that they all belong to. It's a way in which victims and others in the community can be kept safe, and it's a way in which offenders can be rehabilitated so they can join the community again.
Along with Kiribati, Vanuatu has also been a part of the initiative, and Sir Ron says they are happy to host other Pacific countries who would like to study New Zealand's parole and correction systems. This is Koroi Hawkins.
Vanuatu's political leaders expect another fragmented parliament to emerge after the upcoming general election. Following the conclusion of its 4-year parliamentary term, the country is preparing to go to the polls on the 19th of March. None of the major political parties are standing candidates in more than half of the 52 electorates. Johnny Blades has more.
The caretaker Prime Minister, Shalo Salwai, says he expects it will be another coalition government that emerges from the election. Mr. Salwai is one of the few Vanuatu prime ministers to have lasted a full term in power. He says MPs' ability to work together is the key to a functional coalition.
Each one of us come from a custom and cultural value, and I believe we have only one goal. One goal is to serve this country as much as we can. Nobody is perfect. That's why I can only say that I believe very strongly in the value of our human relationship.
In the last 4 years, Mr. Salwai defeated various motions of no confidence while reshuffling cabinet and reconfiguring his coalition. However, the stability forged by government came at the expense of political reforms the coalition promised but couldn't yet deliver. The MP Johnny Kornapo is a member of the Vanuaku Party, which was reshuffled out of cabinet last year.
If you look at the political situation in Vanuatu, it's highly fragmented. There's a lot of many new political parties rising and coming into the scene and rising and falling again and again. It's not really good for politics in Vanuatu and subsequently the development.
With the election fast approaching, Shalo Salwai has the unwelcome distraction of a charge of perjury hanging over his head. He is due for a court appearance next week. And if the charge isn't cleared, it could prevent him contesting the election. The charge follows a complaint by opposition leader Ismail Kausiko into the government's introduction of parliamentary secretaries, paid government positions that the Supreme Court last year ruled void and of no effect.
The Prime Minister had made a statement to the effect that all Council of Ministers since 2013 had endorsed the appointments of parliamentary secretaries, and there is no Council of Ministers decision at all that actually created or gave effect to the appointments that the Prime Minister had made.
But Mr. Solwai says the Council of Ministers made a resolution over the positions in 2013 under the former Prime Minister, Sato Kilman.
Because we have all the orders that have been prepared by the state law, that in 2013, and if we have orders, I believe that there should be a Council of Ministers decision to create a position.
Mr. Kausiko says whatever the outcome of the court case, newly elected MPs should have a better awareness that public money is to be used for service delivery to Vanuatu's people rather than for lining politicians' pockets.
I believe in Vanuatu we've been able to cope with the fragmentation. It's just a question of corruption that we need to address quite seriously.
He says he believes the public is these days more aware of what goes on in the legislature and that voters' frustrations at how the Solwai government conducted itself will result in change after the polls. This is Johnny Blades.
To sport, and New Zealand Rugby is appointing a Pacifica engagement manager. He'll be tasked with giving the country's Pacific Island community more of a voice in how the sport is run. The role is the first of its kind for the governing body and partly came out of the Respect and Responsibility Review in 2017, which highlighted issues around player welfare and increasing participation in the sport. Head of Respect and Inclusion at New Zealand Rugby, Karen Skinner, told Vinnie Wiley it's a significant step.
And I think a lot of people have said, you know, we should have had this a long time ago, and it has been a long time coming, but we're really excited to see this role finally established. In part, it came out of the Respect and Responsibility Review, which came down in 2017, that our board accepted and we are implementing, and there's a lot of recommendations in there that relate to Pacifica. But also, in this year, we're reviewing our longer-term strategy. We have a strategy that comes up to the end of 2020, and so a big part of this job will be to make sure that our Pacifica community and rugby has a really strong voice in our strategic planning going forward. And so that's why we really wanted to make sure it was this year as well.
I mean, so there's obviously different facets. You've got players, you've got administrators. I mean, I know NZ Rugby was involved in a Pacific leadership study.
Navigating Two Worlds.
With AUT, which talked about obviously getting more Pacifica and people into positions of responsibility or giving them that opportunity at the very least.
Absolutely.
Do those sorts of outcomes and that research, does that sort of fold into this in any way?
Yeah. So after the Respect and Responsibility Review, well, the Respect and Responsibility Review definitely challenges us to ensure that there are more Pacifica people in non-playing roles. And the research that came out of Navigating Two Worlds really has given us a lot of information about how we can do that better. And I think the next step for us is to make sure that we are strategically thinking about how we can roll that out around the country. The Respect and Responsibility Review has also, you know, called out a lot about player welfare. We've obviously wanting to keep increasing participation in the game, and Pacifica are a big, you know, priority within that. So there's lots of different pieces of work, and what this role will do will make sure that we're really thinking strategically about those priorities, looking at what it will take to really roll out a lot of the programs that we want to be doing.
And how does the professional versus sort of the community rugby, is it sort of primarily at that grassroots, are there parts of, you know, professional players who are obviously of Pacifica descent that can be used to as part of this, or?
Yeah, so this role will work across both kind of grassroots or community rugby and in our high performance environments, and really looking at what Pacifica people are telling us both in those environments and the wider community they think NZR needs to be doing. And then as we start to map out our priorities, we'll need to look at what's needed in those spaces, both in terms of community and high performance, and also what we need to be doing in NZR to make sure that we're, you know, increasing our cultural competence and being a much more inclusive workplace.
Had you been told that you weren't inclusive, that you weren't that sort of thing?
I think if you look at the participation in particular of Pacifica people in non-playing roles, you'd have to say that something's going on and that we absolutely need to be more inclusive. And what the research from Navigating Two Worlds shows is that there are a lot of Pacifica people who want to be taking up non-playing roles, but there are some barriers to them, in particular about how we kind of view and prioritise and appoint people to leadership. So what we've seen is when we focus on those who are currently in the rugby system and really equip them with more cultural competence and awareness and mentoring, and when we also empower Pacifica people, that we're really starting to get some results. So I think, yes, absolutely, there is more that we need to do, and we're not as inclusive as we want to be. And, you know, this creating this role is one step in our journey.
It's Karen Skinner, who says about 40 people have applied for the Pacifica Engagement Manager role, which is initially for a 12-month contract. They hope to announce a successful candidate within the next couple of weeks. And that is Tangata o Te Moana from RNZ Pacific. If you'd like to find out more, check our website. It's rnzi.com. Thanks for joining us. I'm Don Wiseman, and until next time, a hui ho.